I wonder if any of the panelists, if any of the discussants want to ask or augment anything that was said by during this session.
You ask your question with a poignancy which moves me to speak first. Over the 10 or so years that I was director of the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists, we still do try to foster the kind of conversation that you're describing. I think that there have been our benefits to nuclear energy, and it certainly is an extraordinary source of energy for industrial development, and that's why China and India are so interested in it. It also does offer some help for reducing carbon emissions, even though there are problems there and may not be as great as some suggest, but at least compared to fossil fuels, it is better. I think that part of the problem that we're facing now, though, is that we have an aging technology, that nuclear power plants, nuclear reactors, were never built with the idea of safety first. They grew out of the building the nuclear bomb project of the Second World War, and then out of those submarine technologies, nuclear submarines. But it was, as Frank von Hippel, one of the people who's worked longest in this area, said, you know, nobody has started with safety first and then built a nuclear power plant and then figured out that cost. It's always been kind of on the cheap, trying to cut corners. For some, like him, a physicist, he would, and some of us would like to see this nuclear energy used in a constructive way. But the ways in which our societies are organized based on, you know, making profits and so forth, it has not been a very successful attempt. I think the conversation can best, one of the questions that I ask people is, if you are for nuclear power, what events or chain of events would lead you to actually change your mind and be against the future development of nuclear power? And if you are against nuclear power now, under what conditions would you favor the development of nuclear power? Are there conditions under which that could be done in a satisfactory way? And I think at least asking those questions begins to help us think about what is required to develop it safely and what would completely shut it down for those of us who might, in fact, be in favor of it in the first place. But I think that's the only way I've been able to develop a platform for discussing nuclear power. It's just a very, it's a fraught topic. You're absolutely right. And the other thing that's happening is that a lot of people who might be interested in nuclear power, pro and con, are essentially driven out of it as young analysts and even out of nuclear engineering now, so that we're not going to have people, even, you know, smart, interested, and interesting people, to even talk about it much anymore because it has become so caught up in this, what I think of as kind of nuclear warfare of another kind.
Thank you for that. There's three things I want to say in response. I think one, I don't think it's just nuclear technology that people are polarized on. I think it's society. We are very polarized as a society. And I think as someone who teaches nonviolence and tries to get communities to understand each other's perspective, I think one thing that I realize is that listening and really being able to understand the other person's perspective on something that you feel so strongly about is a skill, and it needs to be cultivated and it needs to be developed. One of the reasons why I started the East Point Peace Academy is the idea that if the U.S. military is training people to go to war, then we have to train people to create peace, that it doesn't happen by accident, that it takes intensive commitment to training, and part of that is training yourself to be able to understand the other person's perspective. And in addition to that, I think there comes a time when you need to do something a little bit more radical in order to create dialogue. the civil rights movement was a lot about that. I teach nonviolence based on Dr. King's philosophy. And King used to say, when he would get criticisms about, well, why don't you have negotiations and why can't you talk to the government and try to figure this out through the courts? He says, well, we've been trying to talk to you for 350 years. And that's why we've had to use direct action to try to shake you up so we can actually get back to having a genuine dialogue. And I think there are times where, and this is something that I really hope to see happen in Japan more, that people take more of an escalated approach to try to force dialogue. The goal of direct action for Dr. King was always to create dialogue. And so I think sometimes I do hope that in Japan there's more than just marches, but people are considering using tactics that you see more often in the United States. And the reason I say that is my third point, and this is kind of pushing back on the idea that nuclear technology isn't going away in 10 years. You're probably right. And there's a woman named Erica Chenoweth who, among other things, did a bunch of research on nonviolent and violent revolutions around the country. And she studied 350 of the most recent people-led revolutions all over the world, violent and nonviolent. And she found that any people-led movement that is able to consistently mobilize 3.5% of that general population has never failed in meeting its stated objective, even when that stated objective was overthrow of the government or cessation of land. In fact, those were the only two issues that she studied, movements that were going for the big change. And so I think, I don't know what 3.5% of the Japanese population is. 3.5% of the U.S. population is about 12 million people. So in the United States, if we can mobilize 13 million people, then history shows that there's no change that we can't accomplish. So I think if we do organize, if we are trained, if we are using the if we are willing to use direct action, if it comes to that, I would argue that if we can get our stuff together, then 10 years is maybe plenty of time. So,
others of you on the panel want to respond to this question of what kind of relationship might we seek between pro and anti-nuclear forces?
Thank you for your good comment. I can tell you about it. I can reply to you, your comment from my only from my experience, and I'm basically an economist, and today the figure and the table I presented is based on the classical economics analysis, but actually after 2011. I strongly engaged in the NPO activity, different from corporate and companies activity, are different from the government activity. And the third way, it is sometimes called third way, NPO was NGO or other non-profit and non-political organization, like. I think for conversation between among us, we need a third way, like about nuclear disaster, but like Fukushima, especially for government and companies. They never tell the truth to us because their incentive is different from our civil society or corporate society. And in that case, we need conversation by way of NPO and the office. It's in my view from my experience.
Judy, you gave us the very that perspective, or someone who's dealt with documentary as teaching and admonition. You have your own answer, your own way to come at this question.
Of course, I always have answers, but as someone who had to hide under their desk during the 1950s with the threat of nuclear war, I might have a different perspective, but I'm not sure. At some point, there's some moral imperative here. I'm not sure conversation, particularly uneducated conversation, is going to make any particular difference. I think the real issue is systemic and deals with oligarchy and capitalism. Unless we bring that into the conversation, I don't know what we really can discuss.
One of the questions, which is the emphasis on the judiciary we saw in the first film, made by a lawyer, how effective the shifting the terrain or at least investing in the legal terrain is for this endeavor of identifying responsibility and doing that in order to stop nuclear power. So I wonder if anyone wants to answer that question. And there's also an additional question that was asked is how independent is the Japanese judiciary? We saw a very victorious moment in the first film, Flash the V Sign, and Nori told us that ruling has been overthrown already.
Right.
There is, however, something covered in the first film that has developed. Japanese prosecutors, public prosecutors, have shown themselves 100% unwilling to investigate with the possibility of indictment. The officially appointed prosecutors have not been willing to do that. And therefore, it took another citizens' inquest committee, a very interesting new aspect of the Japanese legal system, to return the judgment the three ex-TEPCO executives merited indictment. And what is going to happen, probably starting this summer, is that there will be five court-appointed attorneys. This is the largest such team ever appointed of what is already a rare process. Five court-appointed attorneys to serve as prosecutors. And so there will be a first criminal investigation in the courtroom of this disaster. And so I wonder, one of the things that the first film pointed out was this isn't just about winning the court case, but bringing a lot of evidence to light. It is very much a citizen-led endeavor. It took many, many hours and even painful self-scrutiny for citizens in the first instance who were in Fukushima. Interesting, not just Fukushima citizens, even foreign, anybody, seven-year-olds were entitled to launch a complaint. And another minority, so grateful to Cousin for bringing up the constant aspect of injustice and how these disasters, these episodic disasters, exacerbate normal ills, normal injustices. But another very impacted population is those with disabilities. Right. So these complainants represent many of these groups. So I wonder what you think of the question that was written from the floor is the battle on the legal terrain.
I don't know the independence of the Japanese courts, but I will say that I think they're not mutually exclusive, right? We need all hands on deck, all strategies on deck. I think if you look at, again, because I study so much of the civil rights movement, if you look at that history, it took both. It took the NAACP that was fighting in the courts, and it took the movement that was pushing for further change. And I think a lot of the civil rights movement, part of it was about passing new legislation, the Civil Rights Act, the Voting Rights Act, but it was largely started not as an attempt to pass new legislation, but as an attempt to enforce old legislation. Brown versus the Board of Education had already been passed. It wasn't being enforced. And so I think even if you win in the courts, it oftentimes takes people-led movements to make sure that the court's decisions are being enforced. So I think we need all strategies to be utilized in Japan.
I think you pointed exactly, I think, Norma, to what the value of this kind of action is, which is to get as much information as possible. And usually, at least in the U.S. judicial system, it is a way in which evidence can be brought to bear. You can get documents, you can subpoena them, you can look into TEPCO's internal records. I think we have some information already about those records, the fact that they knew that this kind of tsunami was possible as early as 2008. There are other things that we've known, but I think this will be terrific in getting more information, which has been very hard to get, about who knew what when and what they were prepared to do about it. So I think it's useful. In the United States, certainly, there have been lawsuits brought against nuclear power plants. There are restrictions on what exactly can be done here, but I guess I'd like to emphasize that it's, you know, it's not, you're not shooting for just one victory. You're going to have to keep going and going and going to get, that's just the nature of things and the nature of society and the nature of power structures is that if you are interested in kind of getting deeply into something, you just have to be prepared for the long haul, no matter what it is.
Unfortunately, in Japan, the result of the lawsuit by the court, especially in highly Supreme Court, we have three kind of court. One is the local regional court, and second is the high court, and the final court is the Supreme Court.
Supreme Court.
In local and regional court, this kind of victory conducted by Kawai, we can expect this kind of victory. But getting high, if we bring the lawsuit, if we bring the lawsuit to higher court, the result of the lawsuit of the court will be favorable for strong, especially for government and a big company. But sometimes, like Minamata disease, 15 years ago.
This is mercury poisoning.
In that case, finally, the government and Kumamoto Prefecture government and chemical company accept the result, and Supreme Court gives a company and the government fee. And now the chemical company keep paying the compensation for the disease. And it's difficult to change the Japanese court system, but we need patiently keeping our action in Japan. Mm-hmm. I don't know the legal system here.
Do you want to say something, add anything onto this question?
Yeah, I'm not sure I really have that much to add, except I don't perhaps have much faith in the legal system, not the justice system. I don't see that. It's a legal system. I think probably the information that we could get would be the most valuable thing. But otherwise, it always, at least here in this country, ends up being how much money you're going to get. And there's nothing, we might have had a Voting Rights Act, but that's being taken away. We might have had the right to abortion by the courts, again, but that's being taken away. So I think what's really necessary, if we think about long-range ideas about real fundamental change, it's not going to come from the courts, although the courts can provide, certainly SUS can provide, really necessary information.
Yeah, and I think they mobilize people, too. And they give people a sense who had never thought to engage the legal system, a different sense of subjectivity, especially because they're public occasions. People gather. And so I think that part is also really important. Yeah, we've had some hands up from before.
I'm George Borofsky. I study linguistics at NAIU. You also have a fellowship here this summer for the same subject, and I make documentaries as well. But I was curious as to the systemic issues in media concerning this. Like Ms. Benedict said, even calling it an accident is kind of misleading because it was, you know, it was a failure in safety in so many ways, destroying the natural seawall, not building one there, which wasn't covered much, like they had in the town of Fudai. And I was wrong, it was actually the Iwate Prefecture, but same size wave, exact same size tsunami hit there, placing the generators in the basement, like the film just said. But, you know, calling it an incident even is, you know, it's not very descriptive. Calling it an accident is outright misleading. Chomsky and Filters, when he talks about in manufacturing consent, like reliance on official sources, where the government sources were saying, well, it's safe because the levels are safe. And now they've, you know, at the time they had raised the level safe for children to 200 times the original levels, So how much does this misinformation, how much do systemic problems in the media actually affect people in these irradiated areas, and to what extent are they, therefore unethical? But also, I wanted to
say, and therefore what?
Unethical.
Unethical.
Yeah. I also wanted to say, see if you guys had any comment on the radiation cleanup workers that, you know, sometimes they're described as nuclear samurai, sometimes as, part of the term, nuclear gypsies, but, homeless people rounded up to do this work, and the illegal subcontracting as well.
Let me just address issues of the media first, and then I'll turn it over. Are you aware of how many corporations own the media in this country?
Like saying, conspiratorial sense or anything.
I mean, for television, film, print, media, there's approximately 5 to 7 major corporations that own it all. So if you think about information that you're getting essentially corporate information. And you're getting the manipulation of language to placate the people. Language is certainly something that is a living, changeable language, but when it becomes cynical, it's very problematic. And I think it started with George Bush, was it? The first one, when he really weirdly, it was he was appointing Clarence Thomas to the Supreme Court, and Thomas called what was happening to him a lynching. When you take that word, that trope, and you totally turn it around, it becomes very dangerous. So words like accident, disaster, etc. It's these are things that are unspeakable. So what do you call it? I mean, I think people are struggling to try and give it a word that conveys the gravity of it. But it's more about the education of people than the use of calling it an accident, I think. Although the accident's really problematic because it was not an accident. It was a disaster that was clearly planned.
Well, let me, I guess, follow on. You're right. I think when we talk about this technology and complicated technologies, I think it is, it's difficult to think that this wasn't about to happen. I mean, I don't know if it was planned, but certainly there's so many elements of these technologies that it's hard to think that something won't go wrong, I guess is what I'm trying to grasp at. Okay, well, in any event, I mean, starting from the fact that this Westinghouse nuclear reactor was a U.S. design, and it was designed in California, and one of the major problems in the United States, and especially in the Midwest, and you saw the map of where a lot of the nuclear power plants are, Illinois has the largest number. Here we were worried about tornadoes. So where do you put the backup generators? You put them in the basement so that the tornado won't rip them off. And so you'll still have a backup generator to send the coolant around in the plant. So instead of trying to modify, as many of the nuclear engineers in Japan wanted to in the 50s, they asked to be able to design them for Japan rather than simply taking the U.S. models. They took the U.S. model where the generators are in the basement and didn't think about what might happen if there was a tsunami, and there are tsunamis in Japan, not in Illinois. And so from the very beginning, when you think about how these are engineered and what exactly, how you want to deploy this technology, there are already problems from the beginning. 1982, the Bulletin published an article about the problem of buildup of hydrogen in the plants from the zirconium cladding, from the fuel rods, that this would become overheated and you'd have hydrogen, and you definitely have the possibility of hydrogen explosions. What you could do with that is to put filters on the vents so that at least you'd filter out the radioactive material. France did it, the United States hasn't. We still don't have filters on the venting systems in the United States. So there, I mean, I can go, you know, I'm just beginning, right? So there are so many ways and so many, times that where these things can go wrong. You're right. It's not really an accident. It is a very complex technology where external events can make things happen. People at Chernobyl, it was the operators themselves who were trying to do a test on it and it blew up. So there are many ways in which these things can go wrong. And we probably need to invent a new language for it, you know. It's a planned disaster or inevitable disaster. I think you're right that we need almost a new vocabulary. I mean, when I watch these films today, when I think again and again about what happens in these really horrible disasters, which are worldwide. I mean, Chernobyl was the same. We had plumes. It was the Norwegians who first figured it out. But we have this stuff going around the Earth constantly, and we really don't, and each one is different. So it's hard to learn from the past to think about the future. So these are really almost beyond our human capacity, really, yes, to manage them. And when they talk about beyond design, nuclear design accidents, it's really beyond human capacity accidents that we're talking about. And the other thing I want to just draw attention to is the fact that we really don't know much about the effects of low-dose radiation on human beings. We know quite a bit about one-time exposures from the Hiroshima and Nagasaki bombs. We're learning more about what happened in Chernobyl. But we don't collect the data. We're not collecting the data now in Japan. So it's really difficult to know. We do know that there is no safe level of radiation. That's pretty clear from the U.S. National Academy of Studies panels. But we really don't have an idea of, how much you can withstand and still be okay. We know that babies and children aren't safe from any kind of radiation. But we're not very good at even collecting data to know how we manage that, who gets the potassium iodide, tablets, do we keep them on hand? We're really in babes in the woods. And the question is whether we will grow up fast enough to manage this technology in a way that will allow us to continue to survive on the planet.
Judy, did you want to? Judy.
Just curious, is it? It seems so American to me that we're always talking about over there, and but we do have evidence clearly from your work. It's happening here, but we haven't mentioned Three Mile Island. I mean, didn't we have something here, and that's not part of the conversation? It's just rhetorical.
So please, I ask you to frame your questions quickly so as many people as possible can participate in this.
Yeah, my name is Jeff Schramick. I'm a historian, among other things. And what I want to do is to sort of tie in the reference made to accountability and the talk about the media, and in particular with respect to how Dr. King was able to demand that Brown versus Board be implemented. Now, and what I'm wondering is, I would have to point out that back then the media gave him a more or less fair shake in his effort to do that. One suspects he might not get such a fair shake now. I have to wonder if in Japan there has ever been a media as, for lack of better words, aggressive or fair or something as there was in this country in the 60s when Dr. King was doing his thing.
I'm not an expert on Japanese media. I haven't lived in Japan since I was 7, but I did spend 3 months as a research assistant for a Japanese journalist named Honda Katsuichi, who after World War II went to China to interview victims of the war and publish their stories. And he still receives death threats, and he had to go into hiding. And every time he does public lectures, he has to wear a wig, and there were right-wing protesters outside of his kids' elementary schools and things like that. So I think to the extent that they are, I think people would be putting themselves at risk for speaking out. But I don't know if you can speak.
Thank you for your comment. I'm not familiar with Westphalia or media system in Japan. I'm not familiar with that. What I can say is that in Japan, five newspaper and five TV broadcasts is great in Japan. All local newspaper and local broadcast are subsidized by the head office of Tokyo head office located companies subsidized. And as I think in this country, media have more diversity and variety compared to Japan. In my view, compared to Japan. The big problem, especially after nuclear disaster in Japan, and the highest payment, highest advertising fee paid by the company is from TEPCO. And no big TV broadcaster newspaper can not be against TEPCO because it is controlled by advertisement fee.
Just so we don't fall into complete doom and gloom, this is from the former keeper of the doomsday clock. I do want to point out, though, that in Japan, you had the first and only, I think, so far, completely civilian, independent investigation of the Fukushima Daiichi power plant disaster, and the co-chair of it was Yuichi Funabashi, a very prominent journalist in Japan, who, with lawyers and nuclear engineers and others, began this investigation, I think, about 6 months after the March 11th, 2011 blow-up, and conducted that research over about a 9-month period and published it, and in the meantime, helped influence the Diet's own investigation. So you had a civilian. We haven't had such an investigation here in the United States. There certainly was not one in the former Soviet Union. So in a way, Japan has done what no other country has done so far. And the Windscale accident in the 50s in Britain has not been talked about at all. So there is a wonderful precedent, I think, and that's what I want to get to, that it is possible to pull together such an investigation, and it's a great read, and it's a really important and very skillfully done investigation, which, as I say, did influence to some extent the government's own investigation.
Can I ask you, ma'am, what kind of coverage did it get?
I don't know what coverage it got in Japan. It was published in Japan first. Then the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists has published it. It's now been published with Routledge, which is a worldwide press. And we worked hard to edit it and make it accessible in English and to make it accessible to a worldwide audience. So we did some, but you're right. It doesn't get enough play, more than, it should get more. But I think the most important piece to me is that when Professor Kitazawa was involved in it, he then was later kind of, co-opted or whatever into the government's investigation. In other words, the threat of a civilian investigation had had an effect on the government's own investigation, and I think it was, it talked about the myth of absolute safety. It talked about TEPCO, talked about the nuclear village. There's a new regulatory agency now. Who knows how effective it will be? We've had similar cases here in the United States. But I guess what I want to emphasize is that all of this, life is one damn thing after another. And that it's a struggle. It's always a struggle. And I think we need to point to the bright spots, though, when they do happen. And there was a really big bright spot in Japan.
My name is Mo Headington. I'm a former educator, although educating more now than I think I did when I was actually employed to do so. And a former director on the board of the Illinois Environmental Council. I'm right now an environmental activist. And the how valuable these documentaries are to understanding. But I'd like to raise the question of something like the China Syndrome and the effect that that film had on on a vast population, and more recently, The Big Short, and what that movie did for all the people who didn't pay attention to Wall Street. Suddenly, you walked out after a two-hour film, and you had a complete understanding of what was going on, and you walked out of there with anger. So I'm wondering whether there's anything in the works for it, for something that we're talking about of a blockbuster type film having to do with nuclear, and something beautifully made, not something made on the cheap.
I can actually address China Syndrome. China Syndrome was made by, was written by Michael Gray, who's a political documentary filmmaker from Chicago, recently passed away, who did a film called The Murder of Fred Hampton about the Black Panther Party, and also American Revolution II about the Panther Party joining with white Appalachians who had organized into the Young Patriots. He decided to go the Hollywood route and wrote The China Syndrome. This is before Three Mile Island. And they wouldn't allow him to direct it. But they got the screenplay. He would have done it very differently. China Syndrome was clearly prescient and was for a commercial audience, which, well, why don't you go the Hollywood route? You know, usually, as opposed to, I got to give credit to The Big Short. But usually you have to have a love story. You know, it's usually, if it was about Fukushima, there'd probably be a white American journalist going over there to, you know, really uncover it. It's,
Matt Damon.
Yeah, he's a good dude. But once you enter that realm of Hollywood, it becomes really problematic, unless they see some kind of economic benefit. I think screenings like of these films in more intimate audiences, where people can actually discuss it, hopefully would be more successful.
The big feature films that have been made on the Fukushima nuclear disaster in Japan have been heavily dependent on foreign capital. That is another indication of the reality of the situation. It's hard to get money to make a quality fictional film on this.
No, well, Participant Media actually has been doing a pretty good job on some of this stuff, and we should get them to make one on nuclear power. They've done one on nuclear proliferation called Fair Game, which was about Valerie Plame, kind of the outing of Valerie Plame. Whose husband questioned the Bush administration about whether Iraq actually had nuclear weapons capacity. There is a film coming out about nuclear weapons. The Tribeca Film Festival will be shown in about a month, based on Eric Schlosser's book Command and Control, which talks about the sum of the 1,200 accidents that we've had with nuclear weapons in this country. And I think focuses around the Titan II missile that blew up in its silo in the 1980s. There's also a new effort, something called The Bomb, which is supposed to, I think with virtual reality glasses or something, let you experience an atomic bomb like you're really there. Which is also, look for it. I don't know where it's going to be in your neighborhood theater soon. But you're absolutely right that more popularly oriented ways of getting people into things, video games that, you know, which are already about violence and stuff. I mean, you could do some pretty good things there too. But there are some efforts now to get more of the information into what we call popular culture here and out of the expert and scientific ivory tower.
Hello.
I'm Dave Kraft. I'm director of Nuclear Energy Information Service. We're an Illinois anti-nuclear and nuclear watchdog organization. Quick comment, I'm so relieved to hear more and more people saying that atrocities and catastrophes like Chernobyl and Fukushima are not accidents. Because we've been, what was it, 4 years ago we said it at the conference that you hosted, Dr. Field. My question is this, question of justice, I guess. We have long maintained that nuclear accidents are qualitatively different than just about anything else. Severe plane crashes, even Bhopal, things like that. The catastrophe happens, people die, they get buried, you move on, I think as you were pointing out earlier. This is not the case. As one Russian doctor after Chernobyl put it, the 20th anniversary observance, the accident is over, but the catastrophe is beginning. Okay, so it's an intergenerational thing. It crosses borders, as Chernobyl did, and certainly Fukushima. Now you could argue it's contaminating the ocean legacy of the planet. It's a qualitatively different animal. My question is this, and again, I'm not a lawyer, apparently none of you are either. In Japan, are you aware of any of the NGOs who are thinking that if they don't get legal recourse through your system, would they be willing to take this to the World Court as a crime against humanity? And I believe this is something that should also be done with Chernobyl as well. It should be examined. We hanged Saddam Hussein, among other things, for the oil fields that he lit up as the war was winding down and contaminating the planet. Yet, as you point out, not even until recently was a TEPCO executive even brought to court. So this is a qualitatively different thing. And the question is, are any of you, but certainly you in Japan, aware of NGOs or others who at some point would be willing to take this to the World Court as a crime against humanity?
World Court.
In the Netherlands, or The Hague.
I have no idea about that. I think it's very effective. One problem is that, for example, a hundred of movies are screened after about Fukushima accident in Japan, but most of them are not translated in English, and we are using Japanese language. And these two movies are exceptions translated in English. And I think the ability to command English is a weapon. And we need a more English ability, including me, to have a lawsuit to the World Court in Hague. We need more English. We need a more English. Need a more lawyer with higher ability of commanding English.
I don't know of any NGOs that are thinking at the moment, but you know, it's only been 5 years, and people have been driven by such desperation to take it to the. It's been hard enough to negotiate the alternative dispute resolution system, the ADRs, and another very important endeavor that's going on is for the plaintiffs in a whole range of lawsuits to come together and form a liaison council. I mean, just to have that kind of solidarity in the legal battle in Japan is already a huge step. And the criminal indictment has been enormously difficult. And you have to think of these people, the people most active in these legal endeavors, apart from the lawyers, are people who are coping with evacuation, forced return, are they going to go, are they not? The ones who have the leisure, shall we say, to worry about securing safe food. So I think the World Court is still yet. You know, it's not to deny that it might not possibly be useful. I'm not so sure about that myself. You know, countries like the United States very happily ignore whatever international, right? And I mean, the Japanese government is very annoyed if anyone goes to Geneva and says anything about comfort women. It seems very useful to annoying the Japanese government, but it doesn't change the discourse in Japan necessarily. So how to translate it into a visceral reality? We humans are not good at that until we can see these statistics, and still, if it's not happening to us, and also many of us are driven by everyday demands. That's something, and the most vulnerable are especially driven by everyday survival demands, which then perhaps says there's a greater onus on those of us who aren't that desperate about tomorrow's food to take greater responsibility for that. Anyway, question here from Margaret.
My name is Margaret Aguilar, and one of the things that really struck me is in this country, the total lack of statistics about American Indian populations. Their health is provided by the Indian Health Service, which is a federal agency.
Downwinders of Los Alamos.
I was surprised to hear the one about the Mormons, and actually those statistics in Mormons are really telling, because the Mormons tend to be healthier than the regular population because they don't smoke. They're not supposed to smoke and drink and, you know, drink coffee even, or Coke or any of that stuff. So they're actually healthier in general than the rest of the population. So those statistics are really significant.
Mm-hmm. I think you see similar dynamics in Japan, too, because the Japanese government also doesn't track ethnic data for its citizenship, for its citizens. So it's hard to find that sort of statistics in Japan, too. And I also just wanted to say one thing to your point about the need to advocate in English, because I think one thing that the Japanese government does do is that they are very mindful of external pressure, sometimes even more than internal pressure, and so I think there's a role that people living in the United States can play, because especially any pressure from the U.S., they're very aware of, and so I think if people in the United States are aware of some of the atrocities and what's going on in Japan, that can really help communities over there, too.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. A last word from each of you? A last word for now, because there should never be a last word. Fumi, did you want to say something?
Okay. Just to thank you all for your great questions and for being here, and really appreciate it. I think we've exhausted you. but I'm hoping that you'll take Norma's words to heart, that those of us who can have a very important role and even responsibility to talk much more about these issues. They're hard. They're not dinner table conversation or cocktail hour conversation, but they need to be. And so I urge you to go talk to as many as you can about this and other problems.
I think we could, you know, the question about linguistics and discourse is we need to become more creative. And as Casa said, this doesn't happen spontaneously for most of us. So we need to find new ways to make it cocktail and dinner table conversation.
Hi, my name is Fumi Mano from Fukushima. I'm here for my husband, Dr. Fujimoto of Fukushima University. First of all, I'm deeply thankful to all of you for coming and thinking and sharing time with us for Fukushima issue. Especially Dr. Norma Field, thank you for your invitation. Thank you so much. Please be patient for a few minutes. I would like to show you the greatest part of Fukushima, because Fukushima now it's bad name. So I would like to show you public junior high school students orchestra and choir. They has been winning first, second, third prize over 30 years in Japan, even after the biggest desire and accident. Please listen to their peace of mind.